This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Though debate continues over policy in Iraq and the decision to go to war, there are few who question the performance of the men and women of the armed forces. Baghdad fell with fewer casualties than many feared, American and Iraqi, and less destruction as well. Now, the U.S. military faces a new set of issues, and not just in Iraq, though continued resistance there and the requirement for large numbers of troops for the foreseeable future are both high on the list. Today we focus on the United States Army. In a moment, we'll speak with the Army's acting chief of staff, General John Keane. Later in the program, Rolling Stone writer David Lipsky joins us to talk about his new book about the United States Military Academy, Absolutely American, 4 years at West Point. If you have questions about the Army and its future, give us a call, whether it's about overstretch, the limits of dissent, the Army's role on the battlefields of the future, and military culture. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And now let me welcome General John Keane to Studio 3A and to Talk of the Nation. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Neil. Appreciate being here.
First of all, I have to ask, how is this hunt for Saddam Hussein going? What can you tell us about any progress on that?
Well, for sure we believe he's alive because we have no evidence to the contrary. And I think everybody is encouraged by what took place last week with his two sons. And as a result of that, we're receiving considerably more intelligence than what we've had in the past. Because the real issue for the Iraqi people is the stranglehold of fear that Saddam has had on his people. And there's a certain skepticism among the people that he may in fact return. And I think we all underestimated the degree of fear and hold that he's had on the people for 35 years.
And that's not going to be resolved until one way or another he's found or killed.
That's correct. We have to kill him or capture him.
Every morning, it seems, Americans wake up to the news that one or two more American soldiers have been killed in Baghdad or in Dikrit or in Fallujah or in Mosul. Is the U.S. military in trouble in Iraq?
No, it's not. Certainly, we're fighting a war, and we have to understand that. And the context of the war has changed dramatically from fighting an army, which we did in the early days of this war, to fighting a resistance, a guerrilla-type activity that is living among the people. And it challenges us because it disarms our technology. You know, our oversight satellite systems are not effective. Some of our aerial platforms are not. Even some of our signal intelligence are limited to some degree because they're living among the people. And they're not identifiable as an army. So to capture them or to kill them is dependent on the trust of the Iraqi people themselves. They must help us. And every day that trust gets better, and our intelligence gets better as a result of it. But it takes time, and it also takes patience on our part and also on the part of the American people.
When Lieutenant General Abizid described this as a guerrilla war, he, of course, is the CENTCOM commander, the regional commander there, the SYNC, if you will. That's a phrase that, for many Americans, just causes their stomachs to drop. This is memories of Vietnam, and you served in Vietnam. Is this something that the U.S. Army is prepared to deal with and is ready to deal with?
Yeah, most certainly. We know how to deal with this, and what we are suggesting is that the tactics they are using are guerrilla-type tactics, and those are ambushes, explosives, mines, and obviously trying to advantage themselves by taking advantage of soldiers who are going about their duties, helping to protect the Iraqi people. It'll take time, but I'm absolutely convinced that we've got the skill sets, we've got the determination to deal with this. I wish the American people could see the soldiers and how I've been back a couple of weeks from visiting them myself. They are focused, they've got a dogged determination to succeed, and they connect what's going on in the streets of Iraq to protecting the American people, as they did in Afghanistan as well. And the American people have every right to be so very proud of who they are and what they stand for.
During the war and afterwards, a lot of our listeners were very concerned about the number of Iraqi casualties, both military and civilian. Is there an estimate of the number of people who were killed on the other side?
I don't have that at my fingertips, and I'm sure there's some There's probably some estimates, but I don't have that information.
During the war, we kept hearing, we don't keep track of those numbers. And a lot of people just found that hard to believe, that, that they felt that there was a political reluctance to say, we think we've killed X number of thousands of Iraqi soldiers.
Well, we don't go around counting bodies. We did that in Vietnam, and I think we've learned from that. We don't measure the success of a campaign based upon the amount of bodies that we're finding. We're destroying enemy capability, and in this case, we're destroying the elements of national power that were supporting a regime. And that's when the regime and the collapse takes place.
Yet the numbers killed, that's important. You have to know that for not only to see how much their forces are degraded, but it's also going to have political effect after the war. All of these men had families.
Sure. I think that's true, and I'm not dodging the question. I just don't know the answer. And we literally do not go around counting it and measuring success that way. We honestly look at it in terms of capabilities. Did we destroy this division? Did we eliminate its capacity to perform? And that's how we assess our capacities.
If there is a number, could you supply us with that?
Sure.
Okay. We'll...
No, I'm not dodging. I just don't know it.
Okay. A lot of wives have been talking to the media, including one who was on National Public Radio, about how angry they are that their men have not yet come home. How much freedom should soldiers and their family members have to express their anxieties about what's going on?
Oh, well, I think family members certainly have, the American people, they have a right to express their concern about anything the United States military is involved in. What's happened here, and some of the discontent was over the assumption that some of our soldiers would be coming home shortly after we finished major combat operations. And look, we got to be honest with ourselves. When we ended major combat operations, we did not expect the level of violence that we're dealing with today and the security challenges that we're facing. Given that case, the United States Army, in support of General Abizaid, has gone to a 12-month tour. What we have to do for our families is give them predictability, is give every family and every soldier a date of when they're going home. And we now can do that because it's no longer condition-based. We have given them predictability by giving them a date, and it's based on a 12-month tour.
We were talking with some soldiers from the 3rd Infantry Division, 2nd Brigade, last week, and I think it was the day they heard that they were going to get rotated first back to Kuwait and then eventually back home.
That's correct. The 3rd Infantry Division is first in, so they're first out, as are the Marine Division as well.
I know that earlier today, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, was up on Capitol Hill and was repeatedly asked about the numbers of American troops that are going to be required to stay in Iraq and how long they're going to have to stay in Iraq and all what it's going to cost.
Right. Well, the number of American troops in Iraq, as far as we're concerned, the numbers right now are about 147,000 is what's committed to Iraq. And what we have put in place is a number of U.S. forces to replace those soldiers unit for unit, with some exceptions. A coalition division will replace the 1st Marine Division, which is leaving. Another coalition division will probably replace a U.S. division, we suspect sometime after the holidays. The State Department is still negotiating with those countries to make that commitment to us. And that will hopefully reduce the United States' commitment to some degree. But I think in the near term, the amount of commitment of U.S. troops is going to stay about the same.
Let's get our listeners involved. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is General Jack Keane, who's the acting chief of staff of the United States Army. And let's begin with Chris, who joins us on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, General. Thank you for taking the call and doing this program. I have a soldier who is at present based with the 101st in Mosul. He was part of the assault and demise of the Saddam's sons. He is a very seasoned soldier. He reenlisted before 9/11. He felt he still had maturity and experience to offer our country. He has last week called us and said that they are surviving on 2 MREs a day, a very rare occasional hot meal, and for him to complain and say we are not getting enough nutrition to do the job is just remarkable because he's the ultimate soldier's soldier. And I guess I would also have to disagree with the fact that we were not prepared or didn't expect the amount of conflict we would see after the fall of Baghdad. General Franks repeatedly, prior to going in the first place, asked for more troops and more planning for the aftermath. Thank you. I'll take your comments off the radio.
Well, thanks, Chris, very much. And let me just point out that MREs are the meals ready to eat packaged food. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you for the comment, and also thank you for your son's service. I was in Mosul a couple of weeks ago with the 101st. I also commanded that division and was in combat with them, so I have a very close affiliation and affection for them. And we truly appreciate your son's commitment and his bravery and his service to his country. You're right in terms of the quality of life that our soldiers experience. Some of it is tough and some of it is hard. Certainly in terms of food, that's the first I've heard of that one. But we are bringing our dining kitchens to our soldiers in the field. We've contracted for that, and there's a number of them going in place throughout the country. Our goal is to provide two hot meals a day for our soldiers throughout that entire country. One of the things you have to appreciate, it's been just about 90 days since we stopped major combat operations, and obviously we're still conducting security operations in a low-intensity conflict. So establishing all of the quality of life experiences that we would normally have in a Bosnia, Kosovo, we haven't been able to get to all of that yet, but we're committed to doing it. And your son has every right to expect full nutritional meals to do his demanding work that he's doing, and I'll check on it myself personally.
We've, as I said before, heard a lot of complaints. What is going to or maybe should happen to the soldiers who told an ABC reporter that they no longer cared about the Iraqi people because they're tired of being shot at and anxious to go home? They were also critical of the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. Well, some of those soldiers, most of them were in the 3rd Infantry Division, and we had changed their deployment date is what took place. And then those last comments actually surrounded a mistake that we made in the chain of command and giving them some bad information. We were bringing the 3rd ID out early, and somehow the chain of command, it got communicated to them that they were being extended, and that was a mistake. In terms of soldier morale, let me just tell you up front that the morale of our soldiers is high, and they are committed to what they're doing. I've seen it myself. I've been to Iraq, and I've been to Afghanistan 4 times and to Kuwait 4 times prior to the war in Iraq, and I've been with my soldiers all over the world in the last 37 years. And I have never seen the intensity of focus and a dogged determination to succeed that our soldiers display in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it is because there's truly something different here. And what is different is that every deployment the United States military has been on since World War II up to the present, post 9/11, has been to help a beleaguered nation. Some other nation where some thug and post as well. Post 9/11, it's all been about the American people. And our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, they get it. They understand what's taking place here, that we have to kill or capture these guys overseas or they're going to be here in America. And they connect those dots. And it has been inspirational to be around them. They have moved me to tears many times in their open verbal displays of how committed they are to serve the American people. It's extraordinary. I've never seen anything quite like it.
General Jack Keane, the acting chief of staff for the United States Army. We're going to continue our conversation after we come back from a short break and take more of your calls. Our number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're speaking today with General John Keane, the acting chief of staff of the Army, about the current situation in Iraq and life in the U.S. Army today, and about the future of this vital American force. Join the discussion. If you served in the Army, how does today's Army compare to when you were active? If you're a family member of a member of someone currently active, this is your chance to ask the acting chief a question. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And I should say, of course, General Keane goes by the name of Jack, so don't get confused about that. Let's go right to the phones, and Gerald joins us from Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes, God bless you and the American military, General Keane. I'm a retired World War II veteran and an Air Force officer, and I must say I've wept many times for our troops during World War II and since. And I have two great concerns. One is your illustrious predecessor talked about not having a 12-division strategy with a 10-division army, which we clearly have. It's been ignored by Secretary Rumsfeld. And my second concern, which I'd like you to direct your answer to, is I stay in touch, members of my family and many other people over many years before this military experience, and we have a great absence of elites in the military. The guys who are bearing the brunt of this action, God bless them, are the folks who are not CEO sons or daughters, and they are not CEOs. And there is a very frightening act of response by the American public. The elite aspects of this bothers me a great deal, and I'd like to hear you direct it, because the liberals and the conservatives don't want to bring this up because they might have to do something about it. Thank you.
Gerald, thanks very much for the call, and let's get an answer.
Okay, Gerald, thank you, and thank you for your service as well. In terms of the size of the Army, I've been in my position as a vice chief for the last 4 years and worked hand in glove with General Shinseki, who was my predecessor, who's a distinguished chief of staff of the Army. But so you know, during those 4 years, we never did propose having a larger Army than the Army we currently have, either to the previous administration or to this administration. Obviously, our forces are being stretched right now. And that's self-evident. And we're taking a hard look at it in terms of what forces we do need. We're currently looking at moving some military spaces and personnel that work could be done by civilians. And we're looking at about 20,000 of those. And we have had a significant dependency on the reserve components, as you know, for the last 2 years. We're putting all that together and make some conclusions about it. And if our conclusion is this Army needs to be larger, then we will go forward to Secretary Rumsfeld to make our case to him. And that'll be a persuasive case. And we're doing that analysis right now. In terms of the forces in the United States Army, you know, I have lived in this Army for 37 years. And in my judgment, the most significant transformation that has taken place in the United States military post-World War II is the movement to a volunteer force. Because what that has attracted is people of value, people who are committed to this institution and want to be a part of this institution to it. And we have an enormously shared experience with those soldiers of commitment who want to be a part of this institution. And it's remarkable the dedication that they have. We certainly would welcome people from all over America to be a part of the United States Army. You're right. There are certain segments of the Army that are not largely represented in it. People of affluence and means have a lot of choices in life to make. And the Army, for some of them, or the military, for some of them, may not be one of those choices. Although we do have some of them in the Army, they are certainly probably at the numbers that you would like to see, or that all of us would like to see. But we do have a cross-section of America in the Army. One of the things that helped to make the Army successful as we are is we are a very racially integrated organization that truly represents America. And that has added to our success as well. And we clearly want to represent America demographically as much as we can. we clearly appreciate the support that you and also other American citizens have for this great institution. And thank you for your question.
To turn that question on its other side, some are critical of what they describe as a monoculture developing in the U.S. armed forces, that there is a certain political and cultural mindset, conservative, born-again Christian, to put names on it. Is that something that is of concern to you?
It is not, because I don't see any evidence of it myself. We're certainly people in the military are citizens of this country first and soldiers second, and they express themselves as citizens in many ways. One of the manifestations certainly is how they vote. But that expression does not carry itself into the performance of their duties or the execution of national policy. I have not seen any of that. And we're free from that. And what we have is an organization that is close to each other. We're bonded to each other. We respond to the orders of our superiors, and we carry out those orders to the very, very best of our ability to do so. That takes discipline. After all, even the word soldier is implied that you do things that you may not want to do, and you're being asked to do it because you're a soldier, and you step up to it, and you do it. And that's why military life is not for everybody, and quite frankly, we don't want everybody. We want people who can commit to this lifestyle, who are willing to make that kind of self-sacrifice, and who clearly want to serve their country and have the mental and physical toughness to do so.
An email question we have from Lawrence Kelly. He writes, the word no one wants to say is draft. Overextended and disgruntled Guard members and reserves will be leaving the service in droves, and few will want to offer themselves as replacements. Regulars, if news reports can be credited, will be right behind, crowding into the exit doorway. Is there any consideration of this? You talked about the transition to an all-volunteer army.
Well, we don't see evidence of that. We're having no trouble recruiting for the active army or the United States Army Reserve. Our numbers are slightly down for the United States Army National Guard. We are not having retention problems right now in the active or in the United States Army Reserve or Guard. Now, certainly, with the stress that's placed on the force, clearly that is something that we're watching. We believe strongly in the all-volunteer force, and it is being challenged. That's self-evident, because we're stressing it and stretching it. I believe if we are able to do what we think we can do, and that is replace some of our U.S. divisions with coalition divisions, and then get the Iraqis to help defending themselves by having the proper police force, by having a civil defense force that's just beginning to come into place, and by building an Iraqi army as well, then we'll be able to bring our soldiers back, and the numbers will be acceptable. But right now, they are stretched.
Let's go to Victor, who joins us on the line from Mountain View, California.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the program.
Sure.
My question is for the general is has to do with the European defense forces. Since they're spending less money, the countries in general, on the defense forces and technologies, and we relatively are spending more, whether the military and specifically the army has a plan for integrating the two, especially in light of some other questions you've been asked in terms of using more coalition forces and if we choose to act through the UN in the future.
Victor, yes, thank you. Certainly it's in our interest to use multinational forces and also to get NATO countries to participate as well. You're absolutely right. As a percentage of GDP, they do spend less money on their military than we do. And I don't think that's going to change very much in the future, just to be frank about it. But right now, as we speak, we have representatives from 19 countries on the ground in Iraq. Those numbers are about 13,000. That can be a little deceptive because 9,000 of those are from the United Kingdom. But there are 18 other countries that are participating to some degree. That's going to grow to another 17 here in the very near future. And we hope to eventually have three coalition divisions participating. Right now, six NATO countries are participating. Thank you for the question.
Thanks, Victor. One of the units that you're going to be rotating into Iraq is one of the new Striker Brigades. Tell us a little bit about that concept and how it's developing.
Well, the Striker Brigade is a motorized brigade in a sense. Right now in the United States Army, we have foot infantry organizations, and then we have what many of you saw on television, our armor-heavy forces. And we felt we needed a balance between the two so that we can deploy the Army faster than we currently can deploy our heavy forces, but give them some tactical mobility and survivability on the battlefield that our foot soldiers or infantry walking soldiers do not have, thus the Striker Brigade, because all of the infantry and their supporting forces are housed in wheeled motorized vehicles that sort of look like a track vehicle, except it runs on wheels and it has a very high speed rate up on the open highway. And we can put these vehicles in C-130s, which we're very attracted to because they can land on a dirt strip or unimproved highway or road, and advantage moving away from international airports or major airfields that the enemy can target. So the organization has great flexibility. We're going to put our 1st Striker Brigade, which we just organized and tested and evaluated, we're going to send it to Iraq in October, and it'll spend a year there. So we're pretty excited about it.
These are built around a family of wheeled vehicles,
that's
as
correct.
You suggest, as opposed to track vehicles. Do you think the Army's ever going to build another main battle tank?
As we currently know it, 70-ton tank, homogeneous steel, the way we have right now, probably not. And we've moved away from that. When you look at tank technology since the beginning of World War I to the present, the evolution of it, they've gotten bigger and better. And what the challenge we have technologically is simply this. The ballistic shooter is outpacing our technology to protect ourselves. So no matter what you build on a battlefield, no matter how much bigger and better it is, it's going to be penetrated. And that's the reality of it. So we've moved away from the principle, accept first round hit and continue to survive, which this main battle tank we have right now has done for us. And
the,
by the way,
Abrams tank, yeah.
The Abrams tank. We have never, ever had a soldier killed in that tank, which is a remarkable statement and testimony to American industry. But we're moving away from the principle of avoid, accept first round hit and survive, to avoid being hit. And that's the strategy we're moving to. That is in the future because we see the advance of ballistic technology outpacing our capacity to survive against it.
Another email question back to Iraq, this from Yanti. We need to continually stress to the Iraqi people that they no longer kill our troops. They may no longer kill our troops, which shows lawlessness, and if they don't cooperate by destroying all we fix and lack of support of the people, the longer we will have to stay. I guess that gets to plans for how long we're going to be there and what's the exit strategy. And I know that you and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz were asked repeatedly about this earlier today.
Well, I know myself that I underestimated the stranglehold of fear that Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party have on the people. What brought that home to me so vividly was a woman in Basra who told her neighbor that she had taken down a picture of Saddam Hussein in her apartment. The neighbor told another friend who lived in the apartment, who was a Ba'ath Party member. She was in prison for 3 years for doing that. She had taken the picture down because her brother or cousin was killed or captured, I forget which now, by Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath parties. What we underestimated is how perverse and how it permeated the entire country, the Ba'ath Party, and the stranglehold of fear that they have. The only analogous I have to in my lifetime is a Nazi party in Germany and how it was used to control the German people and the Gestapo as their enforcers. In this case, the Saddam Fadian are the enforcers. So that reality is there. The people are skeptical about America and whether we will see it through and stay. Some of the Iraqi people, this is true. And that's why the killing of Saddam's sons was so important to us, or the capturing of them would have been fine as well, to convince them that this regime is really over. We've got to get Saddam. There's no doubt about it. We've got to kill or capture him and remove that level of skepticism that's there. It's 35 years of people living in fear of this regime. And the reality of that has certainly sunk in all of us who have seen these people.
Jack Keane is a 4-star general, currently the acting chief of staff of the United States Army. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You said that you didn't expect the security challenges that we're now facing. If you could do it over, what would you recommend be done differently? More planning for post-war environment? More military police?
Well, I think the plans were in place to react to it. And obviously, General Franks, as as Chris had mentioned, had great plans. There's no doubt about that. He had plans for this contingency. What I was suggesting is that I think most of us felt that when we freed the cities, the Iraqi people would be more celebratory, would welcome us more, and would be more free with intelligence in terms of what's taking place. And it goes back to my previous statement. We just misunderstood how repressive the regime was and how it affected their daily lives and how skeptical they are about the future.
You said,
so we're executing General Frank's plan.
But you said in testimony that, you know, you would like to have more civil affairs troops, more MPs, military police, more infantry. All of that means some less somewhere else.
Yes. What I was saying is that the Army as a whole, to meet its responsibilities in the world today, and that is why we're taking a look at, as a gentleman suggested in a previous question, at the size of the Army. We know the Army needs more infantry, needs more military police, more civil affairs, and also more soldiers to work with chemical and biological. That's a fact. And we believe the forces in Iraq, General Abizaid has what he wants in Iraq. We have talked to him repeatedly about that. I did that just within the last 24 hours in discussing with him the forces that he needs from the United States Army and our commitment to him. So he's getting the forces he wants. And what he wants is a combination of special forces, of fighting forces, support forces for those fighting forces, and he also needs civil affairs and military police, and he has those. Mm. And as we pull forces out, we're replacing them with forces in kind, except we'll be putting back into Iraq more foot infantry than what we currently have there.
We just have a little over a minute left, and I did want to ask you. You joined the United States Army at a time when it was not a trusted institution. It was in the throes of the Vietnam War and perhaps its lowest moment in its history. And you leave when the U.S. military is among the most revered and trusted institutions in the country. What happened?
Well, I think we became more like the American people through the years in terms of integrating this Army, number one. And number two, we had to rebuild our non-commissioned officer corps, strengthen our values after the Vietnam War. But let me tell you, when I've been a paratrooper most of my life, and when I joined the 82nd Airborne Division as a young lieutenant, I had never, ever met people like that in my life, and that's why I stayed. They didn't care what college I went to, what kind of a degree I had, what my father did, and that's the way the Army is today. The only thing they cared about is, who are you? What do you stand for? Are you smart? Are you competent? And will you be there for us? And if you demonstrate to them that, then you're part of the team. And I've been a part of that team all my life, and I've loved every minute of it.
After 37 years, Jack Keane plans to retire from the Army sometime this fall. General Keane, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Neil. I enjoyed it.
When we come back, an outsider who took an insider's look at West Point, the officer's training gown for the U.S. Army. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.